G'day, and welcome to the Sea Creatures Podcast, a show all about the amazing animals that live beneath the waves. Each episode, we chat about a specific sea creature with a guest who has spent time and interacted with this ocean animal. Our guests range from marine biologists to underwater photographers, scuba divers, citizen scientists, and anyone with a passion for marine life. My name's Matt Testoni, and I'm all of the above. And joining me for this episode of the Sea Creatures Podcast is Dave Horasty. And he's a marine biologist who has a real passion for White's seahorse. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me on board.
No worries. So let's kick it off with, I said you have a real passion for them. And when I think of seahorse in Australia, your name definitely pops up. So tell us a little bit about how you got into seahorse and White seahorse.
Well, I first started diving back in 1996. And on one of my trips up and down the New South Wales coast, I stopped in a place called Nelson Bay. Port Stevens, and I dived at a site called Fly Point, and it was there that I saw my first ever seahorse, and that seahorse happened to be a white seahorse, this beautiful gold colored one. And I was always fascinated, so for the next 5-6 years I was diving up down the coast looking for white seahorse everywhere. And then I ended up working for fisheries, and I ended up with a role working on the conservation of the white seahorse. So it all sort of fell into place, and all because of this one sighting back in 1997. It was just a really special moment, and from then on I was always fascinated with seahorses.
Yeah, tell us, like, so the sighting, you're on scuba and you went down, was it on like sponge? Were there multiple? What was the dive like?
Yeah, so Fly Point has been a protected area since 1983. And when I first put my head underwater there, I was blown away by the amount of fish life. There's so many brim and ludric and blue gropers and wrasses and everything. I was like, wow. So instantly you could see what happens when you've got 20 years of protection at a site. And then Fly Point is famous for its sponge gardens. And it was down in these sponges in around 10 meters of water. It was an orange colored sponge. And it just so happened, by chance, I'm always looking for nudibranchs, because that was my other big love, was nudibranchs. I happened to see this gold seahorse matching the color of its sponge living there. I was like, wow, my first ever seahorse. So I got, back in the day, you had the old CNC Motor Marine 2 film camera with the frame and the little prongs that you'd stick out the front. And I took my macro shot, and that was my first ever seahorse photo that I took. And every time I give a presentation, that photo always features, because it reminds me of how I got into the seahorse and where it all started.
Oh, cool. I love it when it's a photo. Was it a good photo, or is it just a memorable photo?
By the standards nowadays, let's just say it's pretty average, but I'm still very proud of it. It's in focus. The seahorse is looking at the camera. I'm not taking a photograph of its butt, which quite often happens to seahorses. They turn their head away. So it's not going to win an award, but I'm still happy with it, definitely.
I think that ticks the boxes. And it's got a cool story behind it, which is, I think, the most important part.
Yeah, and it's one of my most memorable photos. I've got lots of famous photos, but to me, that's one of my most memorable photos, because the whole thing about, you know, seeing it for the first time and the symbolism of it and me going on to work on that species and do a PhD on that species, it all started with that one sighting.
that's amazing. So, like, tell us, like, so you saw this white seahorse. Tell us what a white seahorse is and how they differ from other seahorses.
So the white seahorse, it's also known as the Sydney seahorse. Its scientific name is Hippocampus whitei, and it's got its scientific name whitei. It was actually first discovered in the late 1700s. It was collected by Sir John White, the Surgeon General from the First Fleet. So he collected a seahorse from Botany Bay, and it's described by Bleeker many years later, and it was named after John White. So that's why it's known as whitei. So this species, it's endemic to the east coast of Australia. It occurs from Hervey Bay all the way down to basically Sussex Inlet, Jervis Bay region in New South Wales. It's an estuarine species. It's a coastal species. You don't find it offshore on the rocky reefs. It likes to live in estuaries in those protected bays where there's calm waters. And this species, it's not white. It's occasionally seen to be white, but not very often. So it can be black, it can be gold, orange, red, purple. Occasionally you get the white ones. But what you do find with this species of seahorse is it has the ability to change its color to match the habitat it lives on. So you'll find a gold seahorse living on a gold sponge. You find the sort of the white, purpley colored ones living in the cauliflower corals. The grey, greeny colour ones live in the Posidonia seagrass. So they're really good at adapting and changing their colour to match what they're living on. And the reason why they do that is that they require camouflage to help them avoid predators. So seahorses, being one of the slowest moving fish in the ocean, they can't swim away quickly from a ferocious anglerfish or an octopus. They need to blend into their habitats and hide. And that's why the color changing is really important. And the white seahorse is very, very good at that. Within a day or two, it can match the coloration of its new host.
Yeah, and so I know like cuttlefish use a whole bunch of different mechanisms to do their color instantly, but how does a seahorse change color? Do we know?
We don't know, but we know it's got to do with the pigmentation in their skin. So they slowly can change their color to match that. But also, when they're excited to seahorses, like a dark seahorse, whilst they're breeding and doing their reproductive dance, they can go a really pale color as well. So they have the ability to do it quite instantly. How they do it and what causes it is still an unknown. It's not like the cuttlefish with all the stomatophores, I think it's called. I can't remember. Anyway, where they
Yeah.
flash and they pulsate. Very, very different than seahorses. It's either a dark or a light, but then they can slowly change their color. So I've seen a black seahorse slowly turn gold over a couple of days to match orange sponge that was living on. Pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Is that unique for white seahorse? Or are there, like, is it through other species or all species?
Other species of seahorses can do it too. It's just that, I dive so much with a white seahorse and I followed them. So the reason I know that they can change their colors is, by tagging animals, individual seahorses, you can recognize that same animal based on the tags in it. So you can see what color it's changed. So when I first started my PhD back in 2005, one of the things I was doing is I was recording the color of every seahorse. I was like, oh, what colors are they? And what are they, do different colors attract different individuals? And do different colors live on different habitats? Within about 3 months, I just ripped up all the color data and threw it out because they kept changing color on me. I'm like, that was just a waste of time. What a pointless exercise that was. So I learned very quickly that, recording color of a seahorse for either identification purposes or following them to identify it was pointless.
And so you mentioned too that you tagged them, that's with a little color marker as well to tell the individual. I've heard there's a few cool stories around that.
Yeah, so the tagging of seahorses can be done in, there's several different methods, but the most common one and the most suitable method is using this little injection called elastomer. And it's basically putting a little fluorescent dye underneath the skin of the seahorse. And I give every seahorse three different marks in different parts of their body. So that way, if I put it in like two positions in their neck and one position on their belly, and it's a red tag, that would be like R1, R1 for the two positions in the neck. And then it might be R5 for the body position. So every seahorse I tag, I can individually identify and follow. And we know that the elastomer is long term. So I had a seahorse here in Port Stephens that I tagged as an adult. And then I followed her for the next 6 years. So it showed that she lives for up to 8 years, and those tags are still in her perfect that entire time. It's a very delicate process, though, because you're putting a syringe into the animal. So it's all got to be done under animal ethics approvals. So you've got to be, and
Yeah.
you have to be trained in it. It's not for someone to go out and say, oh, I'm just going to go and tag a seahorse. There's a lot of training and a lot of expertise to do it. And, tagging really small seahorses are quite challenging. So when I'm tagging the ones in the aquarium that we're about to release back into wild, they're very small. So that's a really finicky, delicate process because the last thing you want to do is harm a seahorse. That's, it's critical.
So the seahorses you're tagging in the aquarium, I imagine that's a little bit, it's a controlled environment, but do you tag them physically in the field when you do the ones elsewhere?
Yeah, so we do all the taggings done in the wild. So basically, if when I was doing my surveys, I'd be swimming around, I'd find a seahorse living on a sponge, delicately grab the seahorse off. You'd have your syringe in your hand, and then you'd give it the three different color tags. You'd write down the code on a slate. I'd measure the seahorse. I'd take the sex of a seahorse, was a male or female, and then I'd put it back on its sponge. The whole process would take under a minute. So it was pretty quick. And then what I always found is that when you release them back onto their habitat where they came from, they would just stay there, which was good. When we did some of the initial tagging in the early days, what we used to do is we used to go out and dive and collect a whole heap of seahorses and put them in a plastic bag and bring them out of the water in tubs of water, and we'd tag them on land. And you could tag a lot of doing that on land, but what I did find is that when you're going back and putting them in the ocean, you weren't putting them in the exact same spot where you collected them from. And that wasn't a good thing because what we showed with the white seahorses, it's incredibly territorial. Like, I've had the same animal living on the same sponge for up to 17 months. So they really like to find a little happy place. If they find a little happy place, they'll stay there, as long as it's got good camouflage and good food. So that's why we stopped taking them out of the water, because we didn't want to remove them from their little happy place.
Yeah.
So we tag them in situ now, we tag them in the wild and make sure they go back to exactly where we collected them from.
Yeah, cool. And so what are the ones you're tagging at the moment for? Because that's kind of a cool story, isn't it?
Yeah, so the white seahorse, it's a very endangered species. It was the second endangered seahorse in the world to be listed. So in 2020, it was protected under Australian Commonwealth legislation, state legislation, where it's listed as threatened species and it being endangered. Now, the reason why it's endangered is because of habitat loss across its range. So all the habitats that this seahorse rely on, such as the sponge gardens, the soft corals and the seagrasses, they've been declining through time. And as a result, the white seahorse populations has also declined because they don't have anywhere to live. So we're implementing a whole heap of conservation measures to try and recover the species. And one of those is a captive breeding program. So New South Wales Department of Primary Industries has partnered with Sea Life Aquarium in Sydney. And we've had a breeding program there underway for the last 3 years. Now, the thing is with breeding seahorses, it's actually really easy. In captivity, they breed a lot. So they'll pop out, 100 babies at a time. The male will get impregnated again. He'll pop out another. So one male during a breeding season, your aquarium could pop out, 500-600 babies quite easily.
Wow.
The issue is getting them to survive in the aquarium. So seahorses like to eat a lot. Like they are ferocious feeding machines. They're like, you look at a seahorse and you're like, oh, how's that thing eat? Well, basically with that long snout, it's an underwater hoover. It's like a vacuum cleaner. It just goes around and just sucks up all the, seahorses like to feed on copepods and amphipods. These small little microscopic critters are very hard for you and I to see with our eyes, but the seahorses have great eyesight and they can pick out all these little crustaceans and they suck them down, but they don't have a stomach. So everything they digest, it goes through their body very quickly and then they poop it out. So to maintain energy and keep up their energy levels, they have to keep feeding all day. So in the aquarium, you're feeding them four or five times a day food.
Yeah.
And then you're constantly having to clean the tank and vacuum out all their poo. So you don't want to leave the poo in the tank because your ammonia levels go up. So they're a tricky species to maintain. They take a fair bit of work. So the aquarium program for the breeding program, we raised in captivity, we had 100 babies in captivity, we got them to a suitable size, ready for release. Now, the big question is, if we release these captive bred seahorses back into the wild, what happens to them? Will they survive? Will they disappear? Will they move away? Do they get eaten by predators? We didn't know. So to test it, we tagged 100 seahorses and we released them back into Clifton Gardens in Sydney Harbour. And where I released them, I put half the animals onto the swimming net because the seahorses love to live on the swimming nets. And we put the other half onto seahorse hotels. Now, seahorse hotels, they're a concept that I came up with in about 2016. They're basically an artificial habitat unit that we've developed for seahorses to live on. And the idea is that the seahorses can go into these hotels and it becomes a happy place. There's food for them. The hotels get covered in marine growth and they're covered in sponges and algae, and then on those sponges and algae, you get the copepods and amphipods for the seahorses to feed on. So seahorse hotels are proven to be quite effective. So we released half onto the hotels, half onto the net. And then I monitored those seahorses because I could follow them with their tags for the next 12 months. And we had some really good results. After 12 months, we had 20% of the seahorses surviving on the hotels. They were still living on the hotels. And on the nets, the recitability and survival wasn't as high. It was down around, less than 5%. I think it was about 2 or 3%. Now, the reason for that is two things. One is the hotels means that they stay in the hotels and it's a really easy habitat to find. You're just searching through a 1 meter cube, basically. Whereas on net, the 50 meter net, they're very good at hiding amongst all the habitats. Mm. So they're much harder to find on the net. So that was a bit of a challenge. But then the cool thing was, we saw of the 90 animals that we released, we had 9 of them reproducing in the wild. So we saw 9 of those male seahorses pregnant. I saw one of those male seahorses give birth 3 times.
Oh, what?
So we knew that, the breeding program was quite successful because they were actually starting to breed in the wild again. We had 2 of the animals we confirmed that were partnered up with wild females. So we tagged the females and we saw that they stayed together. So that was, it was a really good outcome. And it's basically a world first that showed that you can stock seahorses and they can survive. And we also sighted, I think, how many we've had? We've had 4 seahorses sighted over 18 months after being released. And 2 of them, just over 2 years now, they've been alive, still living on the net. So we know that if we release them into the wild, they can survive. They will reproduce with the wild population, which means you're going to get more babies, which should then therefore lead to an increased abundance at a site. So it's a really good story. It's worked out really well. And the breeding program of sea life is still going. It was only yesterday I was down in Botany Bay, and we released 111 babies into Botany Bay yesterday.
Oh, wow.
We released them onto just out from the airport. So we had planes flying over us. Now that COVID's over, like the number of planes landing, I was diving there a year ago and it was so quiet and peaceful. And then yesterday, we're trying to have a conversation on the boat and you couldn't even speak to each other because there's so many planes. So here we were in Botany Bay, just out from the runway, releasing white seahorse into Posidonia seagrass that's being restored in a collaborative project with the University of New South Wales, where we're transplanting Posidonia seedlings in front of the hotels. So we've put hotels down there, but in front of the hotels, we've got a seagrass garden as well. So we've given that seahorse two different habitats to choose from. We've given them a natural habitat, which is a Posidonia seagrass, and the artificial habitat. So we released them yesterday, and now as part of a monitoring program with Sea Life and the university, we're going to monitor their survival. And there's three different hotel designs. So we're going to see if they have a preference for any of those hotels, and does one of the different hotel designs increase their survival more so than another, which will help us going forward.
Yeah, like what does a hotel look like? Like I'm just imagining a human hotel with the grass out the front and a building, but like is it a cube, like a cube metal cube with rooms, or how does it work?
Yeah, so there's no doorman. They don't come and knock on the door and like, can you let me in type thing. It all came about because I saw an old fish trap in Port Stephens in Nelson Bay that had been lost. And this fish trap I saw over years just become encrusted in sponges. So within about 3 years, it just went from a rectangular, 1 meter by 1 meter cube to this beautiful new marine ecosystem covered in sponges. And then I saw a seahorse turn up on it. I'm like, wow, that's actually pretty cool. Like, here's an artificial habitat that's turning into a natural habitat. And that's what gave me the whole concept. So when I designed the seahorse hotels, the original ones were just a 1 meter by 1 meter wide frame, and they were about 50 centimeters high. We made them out of an aluminium frame and we covered in chicken wire mesh. And we put them in Port Stephens here and we trialed them for 12 months. And within 3 months, we had seahorses moving on to the hotels. Within 6 months, we had 63 different individuals living on the hotels. We had 18 hotels in total, so 63 seahorses. And they were using them for breeding, so they started to breed on them. They were using them for feeding, obviously, because that's what, attracts them there. The only problem with the aluminium frames is within 12 months, aluminium in the ocean, salt water, electrolysis happens. They broke down really quickly. And I should have mentioned at the start, the idea of the seahorse hotels is that they're not permanent. We actually do want them to break down over time because what's the idea of them is to attract that marine growth, get the sponges and corals growing over them. And then over 2 to 3 years, all the metal would rust away and then they would collapse. And then what leaves behind is all those beautiful sponges and stuff. And that happened with the aluminium frames, but they collapsed too quickly. We didn't have enough marine growth on them. So we moved away from aluminium now and we're using ordinary steel, a mild steel, and that's been great for attracting growth. And we've had hotels now here in Port Stephens for almost 3 years. And now you look at them and they've gone from this cage to this beautiful new marine ecosystem covered in sponges. And the seahorses are living on there and doing really well. So we don't actually know how long it's going to take for this steel to collapse, but I'm really happy with them because they're still providing this amazing structure and the seahorse are living there and they're breeding on there. So it's proven to be quite successful. But we're always looking at ways to innovate and improve the design. So with the University of New South Wales, these ones that we put into Botany Bay, we had three different designs. We had my standard box design, which I call it, which is the cube. Then we had a box-like design, but we made it into a house where we gave it windows and a front door for the seahorses. So we're getting a little bit, just make it a little bit more aesthetically pleasing for divers to see. And then we had another design, a Nautilus shell design. So it was like basically you look down, it looked like a Nautilus shell and it had that roundedness to it. So we're testing at the moment if either of those three are going to improve the efficiency and the effectiveness for helping attract seahorses and protect them. Because one of the key things about the hotels is that seahorses can get inside the hotel, but the idea is it also actually stops the predators getting in there to feed on them. So there's some pretty ferocious predators out there that like to feed on seahorses. You have the striped anglerfish, also known as the frogfish around other parts of the world, like anglerfish and frogfish, they love to eat seahorses. They're one of my nemesis. Then you have things like red rock cod and flathead. But the biggest culprit of all is the octopus. And I'm not a fan of the octopus. I refer to the octopus as seahorse munching little turds. That's what they really are. They get inside the hotels and they're quite ferocious. And I've had fights with octopus over the
Really?
years to rest. Like trying to eat a seahorse and grabbing a seahorse, and I'm pulling the seahorse away from the beak of the octopus to stop it biting. And we've had some bit of a grudge match every now and then between me and an octopus.
Wow, that's amazing. Just who wins usually?
Oh, I'm always going to win. Like, I'm never going to let an octopus eat a seahorse. And I'll tell you a funny story. It's like, I was watching this blue ring octopus, so not the common one, but a blue ring octopus. It was on a night dive. I was photographing this white seagull, so only a small one, and this blue ring octopus came over the top of the sponge and it came down slowly crawling towards the seahorse. And I'm taking photos at the time. I'm like, oh, this is great. This is going to be my National Geographic cover shot, blue ring octopus biting into the seahorse and injecting with its tetrodotoxin and paralyzing it. So I'm photographing as it's moving down. And I don't know, I just had this little conscious on your shoulder kicked in. It's like, don't let it happen. Don't let it happen. So I ended up just like whacking the octopus away with my strobe. And I grabbed, because it just as it grabbed the seahorse, I whacked it and I grabbed the seahorse and I swam the seahorse away. And so I saved a poor traumatized seahorse that didn't realize it was about to get injected with blue ring venom. I never did get that cover photo that I was aiming for. Instead, I got a very happy and relieved seahorse instead.
Yeah, wow. I didn't realize even blue rings. I mean, and that's pretty crazy that you're like, all right, I'm going to take on one of the deadliest octopus in the world to save this individual. It's cool.
Yeah, well, we've got the common octopus here, and this is the one I have my fights with the most. Well, all the animal kingdom, normally you kill things to eat, right? But I've seen octopus just kill a seahorse for fun. Like,
Really?
it'll be in its space, yeah. And I've seen them decapitate a seahorse. I've seen them bite the belly out of a seahorse, and they just leave it behind. And I'm like, you're not even eating it, like.
Whoa.
This is you're just mean and horrible. So, like I said, octopus is a seahorse munching little turds. That's a take-home message from this podcast.
I guess like the reason they leave them is probably because they got such bony plates that protect their body. Is that correct? You reckon?
Yeah, so seahorses, there's not a lot of meat to them. Like, I don't know what an octopus or a fish is going to get, enjoyment-wise out of eating a seahorse. They're very bony. They're very hard. If you hold a seahorse in your hand, people think they're very delicate and very soft. Well, it's actually the opposite. They're really bony and they're really tough. Their tail is like very rigid. They can move it around and flex it, but if they don't want you to bend their tail, you can't bend it. So it is weird that, predators eat them, but I think it's because they're easy prey. They're not fast moving. They're slowest moving, one of the slowest moving fish. They can't protect themselves. They can't fight back. What's a seahorse going to do to an anglerfish or an octopus? They headbutt it. Like, there's nothing they could really do. So they're an easy snack, unfortunately for them. And that's why when we have seahorses declining, you think, well, why are they declining when a male seahorse can give birth to 150 babies at a time and he does that 7 times they breed? The whole ocean should be swarming with baby seahorses. But the problem is that when the male seahorse gives birth, out pops these little mature seahorses that are about, 8 millimeters to a centimeter long. And I refer to them as they're the underwater Maltesers of the sea. They're popping out and they're small and crunchy and everyone wants to eat them. And that's what happens. The male seahorse give birth and all the fish come in and they start eating all the baby seahorses. So they're not going to overpopulate the oceans, that's for sure, because they're small, crunchy little chocolate snacks that all the fish want to eat.
Yeah, I've seen a few baby seahorses in the wild, and they're pretty amazing. The thing I find funniest is they'll latch onto like a bit of seagrass, but then one will swim one way and one will swim the other, and so they just don't go anywhere. It adds to the problem of being a Malteser, I guess.
Yeah, and the thing is with the seahorses, some species will disperse on pelagic currents, or they'll drift on sargassum weed, and they'll float off. Whereas the white seahorse, it's so territorial that when the babies are born, they tend to stay in the same area. So if you have a lot of predators in that area, or not a lot of protection for them, they're easy pickings. And the thing is with the seahorse, like once a male seahorse gives birth, there's no parental care. He pops out the babies, he's done. They're off on their own. There's no one to look after them and say, hey, you see that octopus over there? Don't go near that. So they've got to fend for themselves and they end up learning the hard way, unfortunately.
Yeah. Just before we kind of head towards the end and get into any cool facts, I just have to ask, this thought's been plaguing me. Have you ever wanted to like set up multicolored seahorse hotels? One purple one green one, and just like almost have like a rainbow of seahorse? It sounds like you could almost do it.
I've never considered changing the colors of the hotels, but what I have considered doing is making them bigger and better so we've got stories. So you've got the first floor, the second floor, and the third floor. So we could have, like, this is the penthouse suite up top, and this is where the big adult seahorses can live. And so I have been thinking about making them on a tier approach going upwards rather than going sideways. But yeah, maybe a color approach. I mean, we've put doors and windows in there, so there's no limits to what we can do.
This is the first thing I'm going to do after this podcast is go and look up what they actually look like. I'm very excited. So, do you have any cool facts? I know we've covered a lot of cool stuff about the white seahorse and amazing info, but are there any other unique facts or things we haven't touched on?
Well, one of the coolest things about a white seahorse, and one of the reasons why I just really love the species, is that they fall in love. So a male and female white seahorse, every morning during the breeding season, they'll come together, they'll do their little mating dance, they'll twirl their tails around, they'll rise up into water column, and if he's not pregnant, the male isn't pregnant at the time, the female will then transfer her eggs into him. And then they'll separate that for the rest of the day, but they'll come back together the next morning and they'll do the same thing over and over again. And when that breeding season's finished, they'll sort of stay in the same area. They'll stay a couple of meters apart, and they don't ignore each other, but they're not dancing every day. But if they're still there, they're still both alive the following breeding season, they come back together again. So they actually will breed over subsequent breeding seasons. I've had pairs up here breeding 3 years in a row.
Wow.
So they're one of those few species that, they stay faithful to each other and they fall in love with each other. So I just think it's a really cool story. And it's also, it's a downside to them because it's hard if they lose one of their partners, then they've got to go and find another partner, which means they have to move. And that's where they run the risk of getting eaten by predators or, not finding habitat for them to live on.
Yeah.
But it's very cool that they do show that faithfulness.
Yeah, and so that doesn't happen to other seahorse species then, or not all of the other seahorse species.
Not all other seahorse species. So the potbelly seahorse, which you get down your way down in Tasmania, he's a bit more promiscuous. He'll go and mate with several different females. And, the potbelly will travel large distances. We've had them, recorded moving over 1 kilometer or so, whereas the white seahorse, the largest distance over sort of white seahorse move was 70 meters. And that was over 5 years. So they don't move much. Whereas the potbellies are more willing to move and they're more willing to mate whichever female that they would come across.
Yeah. And another random question. Do you ever get the potbelly seahorse taking over the hotel, or how, why are the two species living side by side but not competing?
So, that's a really interesting question. So on the swimming nets in Sydney Harbour, for example, we get the white seahorse and we have the potbelly seahorses living on the swimming nets. But on the actual hotels that we have in Sydney, we haven't had any potbellies turn up on them yet. Now, that might be because the potbellies are too far away and they haven't moved to discover them. But I do know that they will use the seahorse hotels because there was a person in Victoria that put a seahorse hotel off Rye Pier or somewhere. And that he had potbelly seahorses living on. So they definitely do attract the potbellies as well.
Yeah, I think I saw that hotel actually. And yeah,
Yeah, right.
it did have some pot bellies on it. Wow.
It's the old adage, and there's a famous quote in a movie, and I think it's Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. And that's the thing with the artificial habitats for the seahorses. If you put habitats in place in areas where seahorses used to occur and they might have disappeared because the habitats have disappeared, then you're likely to attract them back there. And that's the whole lot of concept of the seahorse hotels. We're not trying to replace the natural habitats. Problem is the natural habitats have disappeared and they've declined, that there's not many left. We're putting in these substitute artificial habitats to give them a chance to recolonize areas, and then those artificial habitats, the hotels, will turn into natural habitats when they get covered in sponges. So, yeah, if you build it, you put something in the ocean, then the marine species will come and colonize it. It's not just the seahorses that come to the hotels, though, either. So, the ones in Botany yesterday, they had fish in them, they had leather jackets in them. I'm like, ah, I don't want all these other animals in there, especially for the seahorses. So, maybe we need like big flashing neon lights, seahorses only.
Oh, you need a leather jacket hotel next door so they don't have to go in.
Yeah, just move them off into the side. They can have like a little hostel or something.
Well, just before we finish up, if anyone wants to see a white seahorse or they're really interested, or just seahorse in general and they're diving or snorkeling, how would they do it and where should they look?
Seahorses are really hard to find. It's like I said, they are the masters of camouflage and they blend into their habitats. The best place to see them, if you're in a, if you're in Australia, and you want to see a seahorse, Sydney Harbour, to be honest, is the best spot. You could go snorkeling at somewhere like Clifton Gardens or Balmoral or Manly in those protective swimming nets in the harbour. Swim along those. Way I find it is just shake the net a little bit. If you shake the net a little bit and the seahorse is high, you'll just see them stick out their head, or they might swim to another branch of kelp or sargassum, and that's a really good way to find them. It's much easier to find them on scuba than it is snorkeling. Like snorkeling for seahorses is really, really challenging. I do a lot of seahorse surveys in seagrass, and when I snorkel for them, I rarely find them. Like really, really hard. I can dive the same site on scuba, and because you're at that much lower level and you can search at that level for through the seagrass, you'll find the seahorses. Whereas snorkeling is a real challenge. But the swimming nets in Sydney Harbour is probably the easiest place ever to find a seahorse.
Ah, awesome. All right. I mean, and it's also cool because they're quite shallow. They're right near the beach. If you're worried about anything, you can just go for a quick dive around them. Yeah.
Oh, totally. Like I remember at the Manly net, when I used to go out and survey, I'd walk out, I'd be standing up into my waist and I'd bend down and I'm like, oh, there's that seahorse. Like it'd be in basically 2 foot of water living on the net. So there are places on the nets particularly where they are really, really shallow. The white seahorse you can also find down to depths of say, 13, 14 meters, but it is one of those shallow water species that, it's easier to find.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to learn more about them or see any of your work, where should they go and what should they do?
So the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries website, if you just Googled white seahorse New South Wales, they've got a great page with all this information about the white seahorse, the breeding program, all the restoration efforts that we're doing, such as the seahorse hotels. That's a good information spot. And then if you want to see some photos on the seahorses, just go to my website, daveharasti.com. I don't know, update it anymore, but there's still a lot of seahorse material on there that people could find useful.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'll put those links, both those sites in the footnotes of the show. Well, thanks very much. It's been awesome.
Thanks for having me on, Matt. I love to share my seahorse knowledge with others. It's such an amazing, iconic creature, and everyone needs to love a seahorse.
Awesome.
Sea Creatures Podcast is hosted, edited, and produced by myself, Matt Testoni. You can see my work on Instagram at Matt_Testoni_photography and my website, www.mtunderwatermedia.com. If you like the show, jump onto our Patreon account, which is www.patreon.com/seacreaturespodcast. This monthly donation helps with the running cost of the show. If you just want to give a one-off donation, we also have a Buy Me a Coffee page, which can be found through the links in my website. Production assistance by Georgia McGrath and music by the talented and awesome Dan Musil. I definitely recommend hearing some more of his tunes. Also, jump onto the Sea Creatures Podcast Instagram, which is seacreatures_podcast. Coming up next time on the Sea Creatures Podcast, we're going to be talking to Quinn Weitzel McHerrin all about horseshoe crabs, which are one pretty cool sea creature that most people don't know about. This has been the Sea Creatures Podcast. Over and out.